90, a lone Israeli gunman suddenly opened fire on Palestinian laborers south of Tel Aviv, killing 7 and wounding 9 others. I was in the United States on an official visit at the time, speaking at the Eastern Virginia Medical School, which supported our Jordanian IVF program, and meeting informally in Washington, D.C. with various U.S. senators. Protest demonstrations in Jordan over the killings became so intense that I phoned my husband and asked if I should come home, but he insisted that I carry on with the visit. The unrest subsided a few days later, but one never knew which tinderbox might be the one to ignite the entire region. On my way home, I stopped in Kuwait for another official visit, not knowing then that this country would indeed provide that spark in just 2 months' time. My visit was uneventful. The Kuwaiti National Museum is magnificent, especially its Al-Sabah collection of priceless Islamic artifacts, I noted in my journal. That same museum would soon be looted by the Iraqis and gutted by fire. I returned home to find that my husband had been up to mischief while I was away. He had impulsively bought us a new house to live in. One day he had been driving by a villa when someone told him it was for sale. So he snapped it up as a 12th wedding anniversary gift. The house was close to Hashimiya's guard barracks, so I think he felt this would meet one of our logistical requirements. What it did not solve were our personal needs. There was not sufficient room for our 7 children, or space for the offices and meeting rooms we both needed. When and if we begin to work like everyone else, I told him, then we can live like everyone else. I was moved by his thoughtfulness and his yearning to simplify our lives, but the timing was all wrong. With all the crises in the region, we hardly needed a major upheaval at home as well. So we did not move. We would later have the villa renovated for his eldest son, Prince Abdullah, and his wife, Princess Rania, to live in after they married. As the summer began, my husband paid a routine visit to Baghdad to see Saddam Hussein, who was becoming a very popular figure among Jordanians of Palestinian descent for his financial and political support of the Intifada and for his unyielding opposition to Israel. There was also some support in Jordan for Saddam Hussein's complaints about Kuwait's overproduction of oil in contravention of OPEC's agreements, a breach that was driving down the price of oil and crippling Iraq's ability to recover financially from the cost of the Iran-Iraq war. His charge that the Kuwaitis were drilling laterally into the Rumaila oil field on the Iraq-Kuwait border, a border that was itself in dispute, also reached a sympathetic audience. Nobody thought, however, that these frictions would lead to war. In the midst of the growing tension in the region, Ted Turner came to Jordan for a visit. He was, as ever, full of the nonstop energy and limitless imagination that had given birth to CNN. He was spinning all sorts of ideas on this visit, not the least of which took shape on our fishing boat as we cruised down the Gulf of Aqaba. Looking at the undeveloped coastline of Egypt, he suddenly decided it should be the new Palestinian homeland. "Look at all this coastal real estate," he said excitedly. "Do you know how valuable coastal real estate is? Just bring all the Palestinians down here. This incredibly valuable property would compensate them for leaving Palestine." What Turner did not account for was that relocation was not what the Palestinians wanted. They wanted the right to reclaim their own land from which they had been forcibly displaced. Israel had often suggested that the Palestinians be moved and absorbed by Arab countries. However naive his suggested solutions were, it was fun to see Turner's mind at work. He did not even try to justify the ideas that came bubbling forth, pointing out that 1 out of 1,000 had led to the creation of CNN. The reality of the unresolved struggle in the occupied territories, however, remained the same. In summer of 1990, some Islamist groups in Jordan, taking advantage of the unrest permeating the country, made the Jerash festival their target. They brought incredible pressure on the government to close down the festival on the grounds that the entertainment was un-Islamic. The Wall Street Journal compared Jerash to the Shiraz festival in Iran that had so inflamed conservative religious sensibilities more than a decade earlier. There was, however, no comparison, and we were not about to give in to extremist bullying, however sinister, in this agitated political climate. Threats made, explosives found, I noted in my journal, but the Prime Minister has stood his ground. By July 17, 1990, Saddam Hussein had intensified his rhetoric against Kuwait, and in a public speech said, "We have to stand up to those who have come with a poisoned dagger and thrust it in our backs." Seeking to defuse the tension, King Hussein visited the Iraqi leader and then continued on to Kuwait. In his meeting with Sheikh Saad, the crown prince, my husband did not water down Saddam Hussein's anger at the Kuwaitis, but at the same time he told Sheikh Saad he did not see any Iraqi military threat to Kuwait. Saddam Hussein had often assured my husband that any differences Iraq had with other Arab countries would be solved in a brotherly manner, and he had given King Fahd of Saudi Arabia and Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak the same assurance. It was not until Sheikh Saad told King Hussein that Iraq had massed troops on Kuwait's border that the king began to question Saddam's intentions. My husband returned home very, very concerned, and called President Bush and the British ambassador to warn them that there was a major crisis brewing between Iraq and Kuwait. "Listen," he told them emphatically, "you must encourage the Kuwaitis to sit down with the Iraqis and the Saudis to resolve the border problems, and the oil overproduction, and any other problems that require negotiation." He knew that the issues at hand were not just fabrications by Iraq, but legitimate problems that required political resolution. Inexplicably, neither the American president nor the British ambassador seemed particularly interested. The United States may even have gone so far as to assure Saddam Hussein, through its ambassador, April Glaspie, that the United States would not interfere if Iraq moved against Kuwait, a charge she later denied. If that assurance was given, it was a critical mistake. On July 31, my husband told me he was hopeful that a crucial meeting between Iraq and Kuwait that was being held in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, the next day would bear fruit. But it did not. He came to bed very late that night. "I feel terribly nervous for the first time," he told me. We had been asleep only a few hours when my husband received a call from King Fahd, who told him that Iraqi forces were 5 miles from the center of Kuwait City. The invasion coincided with my mother-in-law's birthday, and while my husband flew to Egypt to confer with President Mubarak about the crisis, I attended a family gathering for Queen Zain at Zahran Palace. My mother-in-law and I seemed to be among the few there who were deeply concerned about the disastrous consequences for Jordan and the region. Queen Zain had the wisdom to see that this was a very serious issue. She and I had never had a very intimate relationship, but that day we sat together and talked at length about the dangers we all might be facing. As the Gulf crisis deepened and the pressure increased on Jordan, Queen Zain urged me to take an active role in defending Jordan's position, especially in the United States. It would be the one time she strongly encouraged me to assume such an untraditional role. Neither of us could have had any idea how intense the pressure would become. When Hussein returned to Amman from Alexandria that evening, he told me he had received a pledge from Hosni Mubarak to ensure that the Arab League would not condemn or otherwise confront the Iraqi president until my husband had visited Baghdad to urge Saddam Hussein to withdraw his troops from Kuwait. Mubarak knew that of all the Arab leaders, my husband understood his neighbor the best. Time was of the essence. The Arab League was meeting in Cairo, and the foreign ministers gathered there were being pressed by the Kuwaitis and the Saudis, as well as by the Bush administration and Margaret Thatcher, to condemn Iraq. The king knew, however, that Saddam Hussein would not listen to reason if he felt backed into a corner. "Give me 48 hours," my husband said to George Bush, Mubarak, and King Fahd. Mubarak not only agreed, but he also said to our foreign minister, "Take my plane now and go to Cairo for the Arab League meeting so you are available." King Hussein's meeting with Saddam Hussein the next morning, August 3, was a success. Saddam Hussein was quite pleased with the intense reaction from the Western powers, my husband told me later, and was already planning to withdraw his forces from Kuwait. As proof, he would immediately withdraw one of his brigades, a symbolic gesture confirmed by the Iraqi news service. If there are no threats against Iraq or Kuwait, Iraqi forces will start to withdraw tomorrow, the statement read. A plan to withdraw from Kuwait has already been approved. My husband called Mubarak to tell him the good news, but to his complete surprise, he discovered that the Jordanian foreign minister had arrived at the meeting of the Arab League only to find that the Egyptian foreign minister was, in fact, already leading the movement to get the League to condemn Iraq. This undercutting of King Hussein's mission to achieve an Iraqi commitment on withdrawal would bring Western troops into the region, and sow the seeds of radical Islamist terrorist attacks on the United States more than a decade later. All sorts of explanations would be offered as to why the king's breakthrough with Saddam Hussein was preempted, first by Egypt, then by various Arab leaders who, with full knowledge of my husband's successful meeting with the Iraqi leader, nonetheless instructed their foreign ministers in Cairo to condemn Iraq. Mubarak may have simply acceded to U.S. pressure. Kuwait suspected King Hussein of having prior knowledge of Iraq's military intentions and concealing them. Saudi Arabia, after being informed by the United States that Iraqi troops were massing on the kingdom's border, suspected my husband of plotting to merge forces with Iraq's to regain the Hejaz. Distrust was rampant. Within days, the Egyptian press would turn against my husband and cast him as the devil, which was incomprehensible to me. It was the Egyptians, after all, who had made a commitment to my husband not to condemn Iraq before his efforts to mediate had been exhausted, and had then ignored it. Although my husband was all too familiar with such broken promises, this one hurt him deeply. "There is no honor in being an Arab head of state," he told me. In the end, most Arab countries took a hard line against Iraq at the meeting of the Arab League, while Jordan, Yemen, and the PLO tried to keep the door open to negotiation with Saddam Hussein. My husband, who had clearly opposed the Iraqi occupation of Kuwait and called for the withdrawal of Iraqi troops, was stunned when his initial efforts to negotiate a peaceful solution were misconstrued by the United States and Britain as approval of Saddam's occupation of Kuwait. This distortion would be used viciously against King Hussein for years to come. The consensus in Jordan was that the other Arab countries welcomed a confrontation with Iraq, but they wanted the Americans to fight the war for them. Iraq had always been a sort of Prussia of the Middle East, with its well-organized army led by well-trained, educated officers. That left smaller Arab countries worried about the Iraqi army and about Saddam Hussein himself. As a maverick, he was an unpredictable element in the regional equation. The apprehensiveness of his neighbors was shared by the United States and Britain. The Western powers did not look favorably on Iraq's military strength, though, ironically, the British, nearly a half century earlier, had originally trained the Iraqi army. Interestingly, it was Margaret Thatcher who apparently emboldened George Bush to take military action. At first, the United States was focused on defending Saudi Arabia from Iraq, though none of us in the Middle East believed that Iraq had any designs on the Saudi kingdom. Margaret Thatcher thought differently. She was at a conference in Aspen, Colorado, on August 2, the day of the Iraqi invasion, and when George Bush arrived there the next day, she told him, in no uncertain terms, that if Western forces did not stop Saddam Hussein, he would roll his tanks not only into Saudi Arabia, but also into Bahrain and Dubai, and end up controlling 65% of the world's oil reserves. King Hussein called George Bush in Aspen to urge him to support an Arab solution with no foreign intervention. My husband thought he could still persuade Saddam Hussein to withdraw peacefully from Kuwait, and, failing that, motivate him with Arab military force. There was a precedent. In 1962, the Jordanian army, as part of an Arab League force, had protected Kuwait from Iraq when Kuwait, a former province of Iraq, had declared independence and Iraq had not accepted it. Within a day or so of Iraq's invasion, the Americans and the British were already moving troops into the region, and many more American troops were massing en route. When Defense Secretary Dick Cheney toured the region 5 days after the invasion, he went to Saudi Arabia and Egypt and bypassed Jordan altogether. This was remarkable in light of the fact that my husband was the last Arab leader to have been in touch with Saddam Hussein, and therefore the one person who might be able to put together a diplomatic approach for dealing with the situation. But the Americans cut him out from the start. A Saudi envoy arrived in Amman soon after the invasion, and dismissed as insignificant several satellite images the Americans had produced of Iraqi troops massed on Saudi Arabia's border. The Saudis were not worried about the Iraqis, the envoy told my husband. U.S. aid to Jordan was cut off. The Arab countries, joining the military coalition, cut off their aid as well, though it had already diminished considerably due to the regional recession. King Hussein was so anguished that on August 8, 6 days after the invasion, he talked to me again about abdication. Given the extent to which he was being personally targeted, he felt that Jordan might suffer less if he handed over his responsibilities to a successor. Were it not for the phone calls day and night from many Jordanians telling him the entire country was behind him, my husband might very well have stepped down. I added my voice of support as well. There would be no value in abdicating during this crisis, I told him. Jordanians needed him now more than ever, as did others around the world who depended on his moderation to counterbalance the war fever that was sweeping the region. I urged my husband to travel to the United States and explain his position to George Bush face to face. Our nephew, Prince Talal, was part of the small entourage that accompanied him to Kennebunkport, Maine, and described their reception there by Bush aides as quite a raw experience. Bush himself was very courteous and understood far better than most the difficult position my husband was in. Nonetheless, he more or less dismissed my husband's negotiations with Saddam Hussein for a peaceful withdrawal. "I will not allow this little dictator to control 25% of the civilized world's oil," President Bush told my husband, a remark Sharif Zaid bin Shakir would remember because of his use of the words "civilized world," as if there were no civilization except that of the West, Abu Shakir had muttered. The king was quite discouraged when he left the United States and went on to Europe to meet with heads of state there. He was even more discouraged after his meeting in London with Margaret Thatcher, whom he described as bitter and inflexible. The economic impact on Jordan of the Iraqi invasion was immediate and devastating. Within a week, the United Nations imposed a ban on trade with Iraq, Jordan's biggest trading partner, putting Iraq off limits to us. Orders were cancelled. Tourism to Jordan and the region came to a standstill. In Aqaba, container ships with goods being transported from Jordan to Iraq were turned away. At the Nur al-Hussein Foundation, we began brainstorming about how to prepare families and communities to cope with the economic and social stress. At particular risk, for example, were the women and their families who benefited from projects like Bani Hamida. The tourist market for their products was dead, although Rebecca Salti devised an ingenious plan to find customers for these handicrafts. Some 800 journalists had flooded into Amman after the invasion, and Rebecca and her co-workers set up exhibits of Bani Hamida rugs at several hotels, visiting them every night at 11 to sell rugs to the journalists. As each wave of journalists left with rugs in their suitcases, a new group and potential new market would arrive. The biggest stress by far of the Gulf crisis came with the mushrooming number of refugees arriving at our borders. Egyptian workers fleeing Iraq and Kuwait, Moroccans, Filipinos, Bangladeshis, Pakistanis, Nepalese, Afghans, Somalis, Thais, and Sri Lankans, who had been working as domestics in Kuwait, as well as many Asians. We had no tents or blankets for them at first, and the ground was very rough, but every night 10,000 more evacuees would arrive. By the end of the conflict, an estimated 3 million people had crossed into Jordan, whose own population was fewer than 3.5 million. During this period, I spent virtually every waking hour meeting with our interior ministry and the police, as well as the local and international NGOs that were providing assistance for the evacuees. Some organizations were helping out in the border camps. Others were setting up shelters inside Amman. Our family was very much involved as well. My brother-in-law, Crown Prince Hassan, was patron of the Hashemite Relief Organization, which set up an enormous camp inside a fairground in the city. My sister-in-law, Princess Basma, was involved in helping in another camp. Various European NGOs, like Médecins Sans Frontières and the International Committee for the Red Cross, were supporting our efforts to control disease and deal with sanitation and other basic necessities, such as food and water. We urgently needed humanitarian aid to help with the human flood crossing our borders. But it was slow in coming. The International Organization for Migration took some time to organize transport to return evacuees to their own countries. Something had to be done, and quickly, before the onset of winter. I was reviewing information coming in from the camps one evening, when a possible solution came to me. Richard Branson, as chairman of Virgin Atlantic Airways, might be able to provide aircraft to transport evacuees. We also needed blankets and tents immediately for the hundreds of thousands of refugees camped on our borders. Richard was very responsive when I reached him in England the next day, and he promised to do what he could to help. The refugee crisis had arisen so quickly that there was no time for any comprehensive planning. On September 4, I went out to the border area with Iraq to help plan the new Red Crescent camps, only to discover that in the rush to set up shelters, the site had not been properly studied for its potential environmental impact. When we realized it would adversely affect sources of water vital to our two largest cities, the camp had to be relocated. That same day, Richard Branson arrived with a plane load of relief supplies and the very welcome promise of continued support. He did not arrive alone. British journalists were aboard the plane to cover the story of the thousands of people who had suddenly lost homes, livelihoods, and belongings. On that day as well, my husband returned from his long tour of Western leaders and flew right on to Baghdad to try once again to convince Saddam Hussein to withdraw from Kuwait. It was his second of three trips to Baghdad to avoid war in the region. The message my husband brought to Saddam Hussein on this trip was his firm conviction that the Western leaders and their allies were not going to allow Saddam to stay in Kuwait. "Make a brave decision and withdraw your forces," my husband told Saddam Hussein. "If you don't, you will be forced out." But the Iraqi leader was unmoved. My husband did persuade Saddam Hussein to release some of the hundreds of European hostages he was holding in Baghdad as insurance against an Allied attack. Richard Branson wrote Saddam Hussein a letter of request, which my husband translated into Arabic and sent by courier to Baghdad, a request that Saddam Hussein duly honored. Some 200 British subjects had already been flown out by Iraqi Airways, and another 60 or so would be flown out of Baghdad by Richard during his stay with us. Virgin Atlantic Airways provided the only Western plane allowed to fly into Iraq, an experience Richard described as eerie but successful. Richard Branson continued to fly in supplies for the refugees, as did many other organizations and governments, but we remained overwhelmed. Jordanians extended themselves enormously to help the evacuees, providing shelter, donating blankets, food, and whatever they could. Even the poorest people in the country were giving more than they could afford. It was an extraordinary moment of grace for the people of Jordan. Everybody was involved, giving everything they had and more. There could have been no better demonstration of traditional Arab and Muslim hospitality and humanitarian spirit. Bernard Kouchner, the French Minister of Health and Humanitarian Action, arrived in Amman to assess the situation. "You need to take the media out to the camps with you to focus attention on this humanitarian crisis," he told me in my office. "You have to use yourself to attract international attention." He urged me so emphatically that with some degree of self-consciousness, I invited the press to accompany me to the camps. It did help to mobilize the support we so desperately needed. These efforts complemented the very effective media advocacy of the King and Crown Prince Hassan throughout the crisis. The international community took note, and it soon provided supplies and planes to transport the refugees home to their respective countries of origin. When the government of the Philippines ran out of planes to ferry out its evacuees, King Hussein provided 18 TriStar jets from Royal Jordanian Airlines to help get them home. But the Somali evacuees preferred our desert camps to returning home. I shall never forget sitting with Somali families in their tents, listening to their accounts of the desperate conditions in their homeland. At that time, they had nowhere better to go. The slander directed against my husband continued relentlessly during this time. One day in mid-September, we watched in disbelief as Senator Frank Lautenberg was interviewed about the Gulf crisis on CNN. Lautenberg quoted President Mubarak of Egypt as saying that my husband had taken bribes, that he knew about Iraq's invasion of Kuwait ahead of time, and that he had supported, even been part of, the invasion of Kuwait. We decided Senator Lautenberg must have misunderstood or misinterpreted what Mubarak had said, or that the senator's comments had been taken out of context. But we were mistaken. The King went to Morocco a few days later, on September 20, and learned from the Algerian president and King Hassan of Morocco that President Mubarak was also spreading these stories to the other Arab heads of state. Hussein responded to this latest round of attacks by writing a letter of correction to CNN, which was duly broadcast, but the damage was already done. 2 days after my husband returned from Morocco, the Saudis turned off our oil and expelled our diplomats. I was on my way to the United States for the UN's World Summit for Children and to address the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Our children saw me off at the airport and presented me with a stuffed lion, a symbol not only of my astrological sign, Leo, but also of the courage I would have to muster to meet face to face with my husband's critics. It was vitally important that we dispel the false impression that Jordan had in any way supported Iraq's invasion and occupation of Kuwait, a view that was becoming ingrained in the U.S., U.K., and Gulf Arab psyches. When I arrived at the UN's opening reception for the Children's Summit, the very first person to approach our ambassador and me was the Saudi Foreign Minister, Prince Saud Al-Faisal, an old and respected friend, who greeted me warmly and then brought over the Foreign Minister of Kuwait. As the four of us exchanged greetings, I debated asking Prince Saud if I could meet with him privately to discuss the diplomatic stalemate that was clouding relations between our countries. My inclination, as always, was to put the issues out on the table and wade through them in the hope that something positive could come from candid discussion. Standing there at the reception, and for some time after, I wrestled with whether I should take a direct approach. In the end, I decided to play it conservatively. I did not want anything I said to be used against my husband in any way, and I knew that meeting privately with the Saudi foreign minister might be misconstrued and stir up a multitude of cultural and gender issues. It was much more difficult for me at another event when Mrs. Mubarak came up to me acting as if nothing had happened. "How are you? How is everybody?" she said gaily. "How is His Majesty?" I did not know how to respond, because the truth was that we were both completely wretched. "He's fine, Suzanne," I replied. "How is the President? How are your children?" As our encounter went on, I found it increasingly difficult to maintain my facade. To be fair, Suzanne, I am certain, had only the best intentions, and I certainly was not holding her responsible for what had been happening to Jordan. But finally, I had to say something. Suzanne, I am sorry, but it is extremely difficult for me to converse as if nothing is wrong when the situation in Jordan is so terrible. So many things have been said and done that have been devastating to us. Oh, you know the Arabs and their rhetoric, she replied offhandedly. My God, I thought, it's their rhetoric? I could not let the comment pass. You know, Suzanne, honesty is so terribly important in the relations between our countries. It is absolutely critical, especially at a time like this. She must have taken my words personally, and our conversation ended abruptly. Later that afternoon, I debated whether I should just sit down with Suzanne and tell her everything that I knew. After all, we were friends, and politically, Hussein and I had been the Mubarak's first Arab supporters. We had spent many hours ruminating together over our roles and the hard questions facing our countries. Suzanne had invited me to Egypt for a wonderful trip down the Nile with all four of my children and my sister, and we had welcomed the Mubaraks to our home many times. I thought that perhaps I should try to talk to her to see if we could clarify matters. I called Suzanne's hotel room, but she was unavailable. When Hussein and I spoke later, he told me he had already received a message from the Egyptians about my encounter with Suzanne. Then he laughed, saying there had been no better way to handle the situation, and that the Egyptians were just looking to justify their actions against Jordan. In this hawkish atmosphere, I felt it was especially important to focus on the impact of war on children. This was, after all, a global summit on children. And I did not hesitate to point out that more often than not, children were the front-line victims of any conflict. During the two-day summit, I continued to cite the repercussions of war for these most vulnerable members of society as one more reason to support a non-military solution to the Middle East crisis. George and Barbara Bush were also in attendance. They were particularly cool, which was not surprising politically, but it was surprising in personal terms. They were old friends. When he was still vice president, George Bush had played with our delighted boys in the pool in Aqaba, and we had seen them on innumerable occasions since. Mrs. Bush did agree to meet for tea in her hotel, where we had a very interesting exchange that naturally centered on the crisis. Mrs. Bush repeated the horror stories being circulated by the Kuwaiti embassy, particularly one recounted at a press conference by the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter, who said she had witnessed Iraqis picking newborn babies out of incubators in the hospitals and leaving them on the floor to die. We had all heard those stories, of course, but we had also heard from doctors who had been in the Kuwait City Hospital at the time that these lurid accusations were not true. It came out later that the ambassador's daughter was not in Kuwait, and never saw these things, that Kuwait had hired Hill & Knowlton, a public relations firm in New York, to disseminate the incubator story, but when I met with Mrs. Bush, we had only the refutation of the doctors. Jordan opposed the occupation of Kuwait from the beginning, I reminded her, and we called for withdrawal of the Iraqi forces. There is no question about the fact that a great deal of fabrication and distortion is being used to compound an already tragic situation. We believe Jordan's position has been deliberately misrepresented. I did not bring up the Egyptian misinformation specifically. However, I did make reference to the fact that the stories were part of an effort to isolate Jordan and to prevent any success King Hussein might have in defusing the situation with Iraq and preventing the volatile Iraqi president from becoming even more entrenched in his angry isolation. My husband was being made out to be an enemy of the United States, when he was anything but. Underscoring his refusal to recognize Iraq's occupation and annexation of Kuwait, King Hussein had stood firm when refugees started coming in from the Iraqi border in cars with license plates that read, State of Iraq, Province of Kuwait. Even though it was customary for Iraqi license plates to indicate the home province of the driver, it was clearly illegal for Iraq to have annexed Kuwait. King Hussein acted immediately and ordered those license plates removed at the border. One of the vivid memories we all have of that time is of the many cars driving around Jordan with temporary black license plates. Hussein also made it clear that the Kuwaiti soldiers undergoing military training in Jordan would continue with their courses, and that the Kuwaiti embassy would remain open. I tried to explain the mounting concern in the Arab world about Iraqi civilian losses and desperate conditions. Mrs. Bush was unmoved. She was a political wife, and she was going to believe what she needed to believe. I would continue to speak out after the war started about the humanitarian consequences of the war and the suffering of the people of Iraq, which evidently so angered Mrs. Bush that she sent a message to me through an American official that she considered me a traitor. I imagine that the message was intended to stop me from talking about uncomfortable issues for the Bush administration. I enjoyed a warmer welcome on Capitol Hill. Senator Lautenberg came to the meeting, as did a number of other senators, some of whom were old friends of my husband or my family, as well as others who were deeply concerned about the Middle East. I was very anxious to talk to Senator Lautenberg, and I took him aside at one point and said, "Sir, could you clarify something for me? My husband and I saw your interview on CNN, and I am assuming that your comments might have been edited out of context, where you were talking about President Mubarak's statements regarding my husband. Was there some misunderstanding or some miscommunication?" "No," he said. "What I said President Mubarak told me about your husband was entirely accurate. In fact, there was much more I did not say." Senator Lautenberg then proceeded to detail the slew of outrageous accusations Mubarak had made against my husband. "Are you sure? Are you absolutely certain?" I asked him. Several other senators had come up while we were having this conversation. "Yes," the senators said, "he told us that too." I was not at all sure what might have motivated the Egyptian president. There was no doubt that the Egyptian leader was facing a great deal of pressure from fundamentalists and others opposed to Egypt's alliance with foreign powers coming in to fight Iraq. Most people in the region viewed the foreign coalition as anti-Arab and anti-Muslim. They also saw the Western powers, particularly the United States, as baldly hypocritical when they immediately enforced the UN's resolutions condemning Iraq's occupation of Kuwait, but had yet to move on the equally binding 23-year-old UN resolutions against the Israeli occupation in Palestine. That hypocrisy was also stirring up the Palestinian population in Jordan, especially after Saddam Hussein promised to move against Israel and liberate Palestine. The streets of Amman were filled with placards extolling his virtues. My husband looked very strained. We were both exhausted. Every night after the day's full schedule, we would return to our sitting room to catch up on the events of the day. We monitored all the news out of the United States, which kept us up most of the night because of the difference in time zones. We also tracked everything that was going on in Jordan and throughout the region. While watching the newscasts, we played with two Game Boys the children had given us. We played endless games of Tetris, piling one brick upon another. We became quite good and very competitive. It was a therapeutic way of channeling our nervous energy, and for my husband a healthy alternative to excessive smoking, and it helped us stay alert for any late-breaking news. Sometimes members of the family would come over and watch us, no doubt in disbelief, as we sat there, locked on the television set and our Game Boys. But the news only worsened as the war of words escalated, and coalition forces continued their build-up in our neighbor, Saudi Arabia. Those attacks became even more vehement after the king delivered what proved to be a very controversial address at the opening session of Jordan's parliament on November 17. The government wrote the speech, just as the government in England writes the speech from the throne that the queen reads on the opening of parliament there. But Hussein was not at all happy with its harsh tone. He asked me what I thought of it during a weekend down in Aqaba. I had been a sounding board for his international speeches since the early days of our marriage, but this was the first time we had deliberated over a speech to the people of Jordan together. Our people expect your speeches to express your own perspective, and at this critical moment, if you are not comfortable with the tone or the message, you must change it to reflect your thinking, I told him. There were so many forces he was trying to balance in the country that Hussein gave the speech without much modification, but with instant ramifications. The king had been trying for some time to speak with George Bush by telephone, without success. He had tried again just before the speech, and had managed to schedule a meeting with President Bush in Paris. The day after his speech, however, he was told that Brent Scowcroft, Bush's national security adviser, wanted to speak to him. Hussein waited 4 hours for Scowcroft to call, only to have the national security adviser tell him that the Paris meeting was cancelled because President Bush was upset by the speech. Hussein started to explain, but he was tired of being rebuffed. "Just forget it," he told Scowcroft and hung up. The abyss widened on November 29 when the UN Security Council passed Resolution 678, authorizing use of force against Iraq unless the country withdrew its forces from Kuwait by January 15. In England as well, we were no longer certain what to expect. My husband had had a long-standing relationship with the British royal family, for example, and at our urging, Prince Andrew and the Duchess of York were staying at Castlewood while they built their own home. But they suddenly vacated the house, apparently under pressure, with no explanation or word to us. It was reminiscent of the British royal family's cold shoulder during the 1967 war, my husband said. In fact, the Prince of Wales was the only member of the royal family who maintained normal relations with us during this period. Prince Charles was remarkably sensitive and insightful about the challenges facing the region, and personally supportive of the King's position. He never said anything that was inappropriate from the British government's standpoint, but personally I will never forget the gestures of friendship he made at the time, seeking out opportunities to meet with us and expressing genuine concern for the welfare of the Jordanian and Arab people. The often ridiculous news items about my husband and me that continued to run in the world press might also have made it difficult for some to reach out to us. According to one report that made the family laugh uproariously, my husband had bought a fleet of fishing boats and jet skis so that we could make a fast getaway from Aqaba, though where we would go, and exactly why, was not explained. Less amusing was the story in a British tabloid that Saddam Hussein had given my husband a $12 million antique car previously owned by Hitler to persuade the king to side with Iraq. The stories were all rubbish, of course, including speculation about the significance of my husband's new beard, which some interpreted as a sign of his alliance either with the fundamentalists or with Saddam Hussein, when the truth was that my husband had a stress-induced skin condition, which was irritated by shaving. My husband made one last trip to Iraq to try yet again to persuade Saddam Hussein to withdraw his troops from Kuwait. "If you do not make the decision on your own to get out of Kuwait, you are going to be driven out," my husband told him. "The whole world is against you." Saddam nodded. "Yes, the whole world is against me, but God is with me, and I will be victorious." The king sat quietly, then said, "I can see that you are not willing to change your position, but if you do, all it will take is one phone call, and I will come back to help you." There was no phone call. With time running out on the UN deadline, Hussein and I went to Europe in early January 1991 in a last-ditch effort to mobilize support for avoiding a war. From the beginning of the crisis, the Europeans had generally expressed a far less bellicose position on the crisis than Washington, and were supportive of King Hussein's conviction that war would be a catastrophe for the Middle East. Geographically, only an ocean separates America and Europe, but their attitudes toward the Middle East and the use of force to resolve differences are hugely disparate. Many Europeans equate war with devastation and loss, not gain. This attitude is the natural outcome of two world wars on their soil, and the arduous rebuilding after each, and it contrasted quite sharply with the prevailing American and Israeli view that armed confrontation and the civilian deaths and destruction of infrastructure that accompanied it were necessary evils in the exercise of national security aims. My husband was hoping for a miracle from the French or the Germans or the Italians, but they were not in a position to do much. They knew, as did he, that the outcome of the crisis depended on the dynamic between the Americans and the Iraqis, and it seemed the Americans were forestalling the development of constructive dialogue. Nonetheless, my husband was deeply gratified by his meetings with the Germans, especially with Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher and Chancellor Helmut Kohl. I was equally encouraged by my contacts with humanitarian organizations eager to contribute relief aid to Jordan for the evacuees and refugees. Luxembourg was the next country we visited, and it was equally supportive. While my husband met with the Grand Duke and the Foreign Minister, who was then head of the European Union, I visited with our dear friend the Grand Duchess Josephine Charlotte, president of the Luxembourg Red Cross, and her staff. They were extremely helpful and promised more than $1 million in development aid. The Italians were generous as well. I met in Italy with Maria Pia Fanfani, an Italian humanitarian, and with an Italian NGO focused on development programs for women. They were both very responsive to the needs of refugees fleeing Iraq and Kuwait who had chosen to stay in Jordan and desperately needed to begin generating some income for their families. Princess Irene of Greece, an old family friend and sister of the Queen of Spain, came in and out of Jordan often during this period to help in any way she could. Princess Irene's foundation, World in Harmony, supported projects in the developing world and worked with the Nur al-Hussein Foundation to help the very poorest families in the country. Hussein also met with John Major, Britain's new prime minister, and found him impressively informed and more down-to-earth than Margaret Thatcher. Hussein was buoyed by Major's insistence that Iraq would not be attacked if it withdrew from Kuwait. Yet the specter of conflict still loomed. On January 5, the day after Hussein met with Prime Minister Major, he went out to Castlewood to meet secretly with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. With war apparently inevitable, my husband had mobilized Jordanian troops on the border with Iraq and on the border with Israel to keep Jordan from being overrun. Shamir said his generals were urging him to place Israeli troops opposite the Jordanian troops, a call he was resisting until he had spoken face to face with my husband. "Your Majesty, what we want to know is why your troops are massed on our border, and what you will do if Iraq crosses your borders and tries to attack Israel." My husband replied, "My position is purely defensive. If anybody crosses my borders or enters my airspace, from Iraq or anywhere else, I will treat that as a hostile act and will act accordingly. And I will not allow anyone to attack anyone else through Jordan." Shamir replied, "Thank you. That's all I wanted to hear." However, Ehud Barak, the chief of staff of the Israeli Defense Forces, was more suspicious about the concentration of Jordanian troops on Israel's border. When Sharif Zayed bin Shaker, who had spent 35 years in the Jordanian army, pointed out that the Jordanian troops were obviously in a defensive rather than offensive position, Barak kept demanding more assurances until Shamir lost his patience. "King Hussein has given me his word," he said, "and that is enough for me." When my husband returned to Jordan at the end of our European tour, I continued on to Austria with the four youngest children, then ages 10, 8, 7, and 4, to leave them for their school holiday with my sister. My heart had never felt as heavy, but it was important that they be distanced from the tension at home as much as possible. I still refused to believe that war lay ahead. But were it to come, the children would be out of harm's way, leaving us to fully focus on our larger Jordanian family. My time with the children in Austria was all too limited, but as short as it was my first undistracted contact with them during the last 4 months of deepening crisis. The simple act of reading them a bedtime story reduced me to tears. I tried not to focus on our parting, but it was impossible. I was going to spend only 2 days in Austria, but even that short visit proved problematic. I was concerned with how my absence would be perceived in Jordan only a few days before the UN deadline. However, at my husband's urging, I stayed on. My apprehension proved to be correct when my husband called to say that yes, indeed, there was a lot of speculation about why I was out of the country. "Of course there is. I should be home in Jordan," I said. I left the next day, after discussing with my sister what to do about the children if their father and I did not survive. The last day I spent with the children was emotionally draining for all of us. "My heart is breaking," I wrote in my journal. "We must be prepared for anything in the event of war." I gave each child a precious, sentimental good luck gift and promised the children that this would be just a temporary separation. But in my heart, I was not at all sure. Chapter 16. Fire in the Gulf. As the January 15 deadline for Iraq's withdrawal from Kuwait passed, the tension in Amman was extraordinary. After the U.S. media declared the importance of clear skies for any coalition attack, the weather became a source of constant debate and discussion. The King and I monitored the news without pause, as everyone's nerves wound tighter and tighter. Increasingly agitated anti-war demonstrators marched in capitals around the world, reminiscent of the anti-Vietnam War protests during my student days. I felt as though my past was being replayed. "It seems so surreal," I wrote in my journal. "I only pray that whatever happens will be for the best. Let it become indisputably clear that war is not a solution for economic, social, or political problems." Our friends supported us tremendously by calling and sending messages. My family was very concerned, naturally, and called from the States, as did old school friends in America and England, and leaders from around the world. There was always someone, it seemed, on the phone, but never George Bush or Saddam Hussein. On January 17, we learned later, Bush called King Fahd and President Mubarak to tell them the air war was about to begin, and James Baker called the Soviets. Hussein and I found out on CNN that the war had started. We sat in front of the television, devastated, as we watched the opening bombardment of Baghdad. The King acutely appreciated the potential consequences of the assault and the furies it would unleash. Divisions between Arab countries would be exacerbated, and extremists would bring terrific pressure to bear by depicting their governments as puppets of the West. The economic consequences also would be very grave, particularly for poor countries. Saudi Arabia's willingness to accept foreign troops on its sacred soil would be seen as a humiliation to all Arabs, especially in a region that was so sensitive to colonialism. Anti-American feelings on the streets of Jordan and throughout the region would reach an all-time high, fanned by those trying to cast the bombing of Baghdad in religious terms as an assault by Christian and Jewish forces against Islam. My husband saw the strong possibility of these forces spiraling out of control and was heartsick at his helplessness to do anything to stop it. Upon hearing the news, Alexa immediately phoned me, and I asked her to take Hamza, Hashim, Iman, and Raya to London to finish their holiday. They were indignant at being kept away from Amman, and they started calling and writing to entreat us to let them return home. But we resisted their pleas. They were in very good hands. They tried to sneak out of bed at night to watch CNN, I learned later, because my sister and my mother thought the images of the bombing of Baghdad would be too disturbing for them, and had made the TV off limits. I was very grateful to my family for responding so quickly and being so sensitive to the needs of my children. Hussein's eldest sons, Abdullah and Faisal, and his nephew Talal, were officers in the military, which was called to active duty during the crisis. When the Army Chief of Staff asked my husband what he wanted him to do with the members of the royal family, my husband said, "Absolutely nothing. They will join their units and be treated like any other officer. If any Jordanian soldier is going to be placed in harm's way, so should the king's family." This was not unusual. The entire royal family, men and women, had been brought up to serve the country, and the boys would have felt disgraced if they had been set apart in any way. Foreigners in Amman felt increasingly vulnerable. I spent part of the second day of the war in the hospital visiting an Italian journalist, Eric Salerno, who had been beaten by a group of Jordanians. He was the exception, for despite the tensions, hundreds of journalists were free to go anywhere they wanted and rarely encountered any hostility. Still, I was concerned, so from the hospital I went directly to the Intercontinental Hotel, where many journalists were staying, to determine their security needs and make sure they were well provided for. Other foreign-born Jordanians took their own precautions. Prince Raad's wife, Majda, who was born in Sweden, curtailed her movements outside her home for a period of time, as did the wives of foreign diplomats, many of whom eventually left. Lisa Segovia, our longtime German head of housekeeping, who had lived in Amman for many years, became painfully aware of the transformation in attitudes toward foreigners in her daily dealings with the shopkeepers and market vendors she patronized for the palace. Nonetheless, she felt safe and comfortable in Jordan and chose to wait out the crisis. Just as my husband was constantly moving from the Situation Room in the Diwan to the refugee camps, to all the units of the army, where he made it a point to greet and encourage every soldier, I was always on the go myself. Cholera had been reported at one of our refugee camps, and we had an urgent need for more blankets and warm clothing as the winter rains began, so I devoted myself to these tasks. With each passing day, public sentiment in Jordan became more and more supportive of Saddam Hussein. He became an overnight Arab hero when he launched his first Scud missiles into Israel on January 17. 2 days later, the mood on the streets became almost euphoric when at least 3 Iraqi Scuds hit Tel Aviv, especially since it had happened after U.S. reports that Saddam Hussein had been effectively neutralized. Such overblown coalition claims fueled the myth that Saddam Hussein was invincible. I clung stubbornly to the hope that it would become clear to all that war was not a solution, only a multiplier of suffering. Successful missions, as the White House and the Defense Department described them, meant death for Iraqi civilians that we, or people close to us, knew. Those innocent victims were our neighbors. The Iraqi torching of Kuwait's oil fields in late January created a whole new level of insanity. What could possibly be gained by such senseless destruction? The sight brought my husband, who had spoken out passionately about the potential environmental catastrophe of war, close to tears. The children arrived home from London at the end of their winter school holiday to begin the new school term. They were as thrilled to be back as we were to have them there, though the danger had not lessened. Scuds were still flying. Their school friends had seen them from their rooftops at night. Now school lessons included learning the difference between alarm bells for fire and air raids, and the appropriate procedures to follow. Close the windows for a fire to limit the supply of oxygen. Open them for air raids to minimize shattering glass. In case of an air raid on their way home from school, the children were instructed to jump out of the car and get as far away from it as possible, since cars were easy targets. As the air war continued, every Iraqi Scud launched at Israel or Saudi Arabia raised fears in Jordan that the warheads might contain chemical or biological weapons. Some people hung litmus paper in their houses to determine if there were chemical agents in the air. Others taped their windows shut. The demand for gas masks grew. I learned that residents of Tel Aviv were so jumpy that many families relocated to Jerusalem, the assumption being that Saddam Hussein would not risk harming the Al-Aqsa Mosque and other sacred Muslim sites there. We were especially vulnerable at Al-Nadwa. The palace was very close to the airport, which would be an obvious target if hostilities escalated. Security pressed us to move, but the king and I decided to stay in our home, just as other Jordanians were remaining in theirs. Hussein's greatest preoccupation was the safety of the country. Roads into Jordan were being targeted by Allied warplanes, and oil trucks carrying perfectly legal oil into our country were being bombed. A rationing system had already been put into place because of the Saudi decision to cut off our oil. Cars with even-numbered license plates were allowed on the roads one day, and those with odd-numbered licenses the next. But still, the lack of fuel was becoming a national crisis. So was the carnage along the highway from Baghdad to Amman, with civilian cars and trucks and buses coming under steady Allied attacks, with a mounting loss of Jordanian life. The king felt he could not remain silent in light of the ongoing devastation of neighboring Iraq and its effects on Jordanians.